Hello and welcome back to the ISB podcast. It's April 2026 and I'm very much looking forward to introducing you to our proceedings. My name is Andreas Barco. I chair the ISB.
Hello, everyone. My name is Hagit. I'm a board member at the ISB, and I'm very happy to join you today, Andreas, and speak about our April 2026 meeting that we've just completed this week. So this week, we've discussed six projects, and we also discussed consistent application activities. So today, Andreas and myself, right, we will cover three topics. We'll start with FICE, so financial instrument with characteristics of equity, amortized cost measurement, and BCDGI, which is business combination disclosure and goodwill impairment. Now taking a big breath and moving on to Andreas.
Thanks, Hagi. We do love our acronyms, don't we?
We do.
So on to FICE. To provide you a little bit with a project background and remind everyone of what the project objectives were, we actually put down three project objectives. We firstly wanted to clarify the distinction between financial liabilities and equity instruments on a company's balance sheet, especially those financial instruments that have the characteristics of both debt and equity. Then secondly, we wanted to address known practice issues in IAS 32. So if you look into those issues that have come to the Interpretations Committee over the many years, you know what we are talking about. And thirdly, we wanted to improve the information presented and disclosed about issued financial instruments. After exposing the exposure draft and conducting outreach and consultation, the ISB has been deliberating the proposals in the ED topic by topic. So if I reflect on what progress we've made to date, we've concluded the decision-making on proposals relating to presentation of equity instruments and to some of the decisions made on disclosures that originated from the discussion paper and a number of classification topics such as shareholder discretion, reclassification, and fixed-for-fixed condition. Now, I think it is important to remind stakeholders that the board decided back in July 2025 not to proceed with its proposals around the effects of laws and regulations, but to maintain the status quo for now. So, Hagit, could you take us through what we discussed and decided in April?
So the proposals in the ED that relates to financial instruments containing contingent settlement provisions attracted substantial feedback from our stakeholders. It is because there is diversity in practice, but to be completely fair to our stakeholders, not just because of that. So we had to collect the feedback and discuss several aspects that relate to contingent settlement provisions proposals. So this is the type of financial instrument that we really mean to include in the scope. It's how to account for discretionary payments, measurement of financial liability, and the meaning of the terms liquidation and non-genuine. So if I start with the measurement requirements, so our decision reflects feedback from stakeholders. So when we propose the requirement on the measurement that relates to those instruments, we were thinking that we want to reduce diversity in practice. We wanted to provide clarity, and we also wanted to deal with the day two accounting. And we exposed those requirements with the best intentions, and those intentions were greatly appreciated by our stakeholders. But still, our stakeholders were honest with us and tell us, look, it's not really working. It's not really operational. The information that we get from applying those requirements sometimes are really not useful. And actually, our measurement requirements belong in IAS 32, isn't it belonging better in IFRS 9? And we really took to heart those comments from our stakeholders, and we want to deliver on this request. So our first thought is, first of all, let's think again on our proposals and where do they belong. If we are talking about measurement, maybe IFRS 9 project, a project that relates to IFRS 9 would be the right place for it. And we do have the amortized cost measurement project. So we've decided to continue the discussion within the amortized cost measurement project. And I guess for me, it is a natural fit in a sense because this project also relates to changes in cash flows that relates to contingent events, but also amortized cost method is a method that we have. It's a method that we know. People are familiar with it. So it's a good question to test ourselves. Is this method working for those kind of instruments? Do we need to tweak it a bit? Maybe it will be a smaller leap for our stakeholders instead of the original proposal. And I think there are many of us that are enthusiastic about trying to test this approach.
Exactly right. Well, if I then take it to the next area, which is scope and discretionary payments, and I'm probably getting a little bit more nitty-gritty here. Mm-hmm. So we decided to clarify the contingent settlement provision requirements that apply to a financial instrument or a component of it that could require settlement given rise to a financial liability only because of an uncertain future event beyond the control of both the issuer and the holder. If it wasn't for the contingent settlement provision, that instrument would have been classified as equity. Now, we decided to clarify that discretionary payments are recognized in equity even if the equity component of a compound financial instrument has an initial carrying amount of zero. We also decided to amend the wording in paragraph 36 of IAS 32 to remove an internal inconsistency. So I think that that point is quite important because many stakeholders actually asked, if you have an initial value of zero to equity, does that instrument really have an equity portion? Or is it not just a pure liability instrument? And we said, no. It could very well be that the equity portion exists even if it is assigned a zero value at initial recognition. So that is just to explain how we arrived at that particular point.
So next we discussed the definition of liquidation and not genuine. So we accept that clarifying the meaning of both is going to be tricky. To be honest, I think looking from outside the organization and looking in, it's really interesting. You're working with so many jurisdictions. They have so many different legal frameworks and also many different languages. Translating non-genuine to a different language is genuinely not easy. And I think we all recognize that. So we made an extra effort to go a further step to try to help our stakeholders here. So we decided to describe the liquidation process by focusing on its objective. So the objective is to permanently cease an entity's operation, and it includes activities such as converting assets, paying obligations, and settling equity claims. I think what was interesting here, we tried many ways, and I think all of us felt comfortable with looking at the objective. But once one of the board members said, but I want to be clear, this is not resolution. Let's also be clear what it is not. And I thought it was really useful.
Absolutely.
Also, we decided to clarify that the assessment of whether a contractual term is not genuine required judgment. And in making such assessment, an entity considers both the probability and the nature of the contingent event. And here we said you need to think about whether the event has a substantive business purpose as well. So in terms of next step, we continue to redeliberate the remaining topics in the ED. And our purpose is to complete the redeliberation by the end of this year.
Splendid. And obviously, we hope that we are able to do that. Shall we move to the next item on that we featured for this podcast, which is amortized cost measurement? Again, if I can give our listeners a little bit of project background, we started that project in response to stakeholder feedback on the PIRs of IFRS 9 that were held before. The objectives of this project are to resolve widespread application issues arising from amortized cost requirements in IFRS 9 by clarifying the underlying principles and adding application guidance. And the majority of these questions really center around two paragraphs in the application guidance section, which is B545 and B546. We also decided that the objective are to improve information provided to users of financial statements about the effects of modifications, derecognition, and write-offs on an entity's financial instruments and how these events relate to each other. Now, if we turn to the progress that we've made to date, last year, the IASB finalized the project objectives, the approach, the scope, and the project criteria, so the areas that we would look into and the areas that we would not look into. We met with stakeholders to identify the root causes of the diversity in practice relating to amortized cost measurement requirements, so many issues related to the effective interest rate calculation. And we began the deliberations of potential solutions from Q3 in 2025 in consultation with our stakeholders. So can I again turn it to you, Hagi, to lead us through the April meeting focus?
Absolutely. So in September, we started discussing potential clarification about what kind of changes in estimate in the contractual cash flows should be accounted by adjusting the effective interest rate, which is kind of a prospective approach, versus by recognizing a catch-up adjustment. And we need to be clear when we speak about changes in cash flows in this particular sense. We are talking about changes in estimated cash flows from pre-existing terms. We are not talking about modifications, especially not at this point of the project. It will come later. So in September, we've discussed three potential alternatives for clarifying the relevant requirements. And since then, we've done a big roadshow with our three approaches, speaking with many stakeholders, speaking with investors to try to see whether it will work. And it was a very good and interesting exercise for us because we've learned that our stakeholders are trying to balance and trying to tell us to balance conceptual merits with what is practical. And actually where they try to lead us is to a combination, something in between those three approaches, which is really interesting to learn. So what we've heard, I think I'll try to summarize in a quick sentence. Investors are telling us, look, mostly, I think business as usual. When business is not as usual, when something is really special, I want to see a catch-up adjustment. Otherwise, the other things really relate to credit risk, interest rate risk. Fine, that needs to go to the effective interest rate. And that really led us to develop this solution. And we decided to require the changes in contractual cash flows that provide consideration for the time value of money or credit risk are accounted for by adjusting the effective interest rate, which is this prospective accounting method. And then other changes, those special ones, as they said, will continue to be recognized as a catch-up adjustment. And we do expect that it will provide useful information based on this feedback. So useful for investors. We expect that it will improve consistency, and we actually think it will be operational as well. So I think for me, it's really interesting to hear that feedback and to learn what comes into each bucket of this accounting. In terms of the next steps, we're working towards an exposure draft. We aim to complete substantially our redeliberations of the proposals by the end of this year.
So this is already the second time that we've mentioned end of this year, yeah. But just to manage the expectations, you will not find an exposure draft under your Christmas tree, so rest assured that will come probably sometime later, but we want to finish our deliberations by then.
Correct.
So let's then turn to the last project, which is business combinations, disclosures, goodwill and impairment. That project's objective is to improve the information companies provide as a package to investors about business combinations, and they do so at a reasonable cost. So the cost benefit is really front and center in those deliberations. What progress have we made to date? Over the entire year, last year, if you've listened to our podcast, you will remember that the ISB has completed an initial analysis of feedback on all the proposals, except for subsidiaries without public accountability and the transition requirements. And we have made tentative decisions on some aspects of the proposed amendments. The staff have been consulting on some parts of the project. So in this meeting, we started discussing the additional feedback from those consultations and making decisions on some topics. Hagit, over to you.
Yes, I'm happy to take this from here. So we've discussed a subset of business combinations. So what is this tool, this subset? We were aiming with identifying a subset of business combination to require performance information, which means target, subsequent performance, to be applied only for a subset of the business combination. That was our approach in the proposals. And the purpose here is to balance cost and usefulness of information so we can only only focus on the most significant transaction. Now, let's go define significant transaction. We did make a very good attempt, and our stakeholders made an excellent attempt to help us go through this. So first of all, based on the feedback and our analysis, the staff analysis, we decided to confirm the proposal to require a company to disclose performance information for only a subset. We think this mechanism is a good mechanism. It provides that balance. And then we had to discuss whether we want to retain the threshold approach for identifying those business combinations, or do we want to consider something else. Now, I have to be completely honest. I really wanted something else to work. and also our stakeholders, to be fair, I'm not on my own camp here. Our stakeholders told us, do you want to try something else, maybe more principle-based, maybe check the rebuttable presumption? And our staff worked really hard to try to see whether an alternative approach would work. And as much as I did want it to work, I have to admit I was, together with the other board members, agreeing that a threshold approach is probably better. Rebuttable presumption, although conceptually can work, but operationally can be very difficult. And when we think of our stakeholders and preparers, we want to deliver something that works. So we maintained the threshold approach, and we were thinking of further refinement to this approach based on the feedback that we received. So we had a threshold that relates to operating profit. The feedback was very clear. This one is not going to work. We tried to think of different things, but at the end of the day, we decided to remove this threshold. We also decided to remove the proposed threshold that relates to qualitative thresholds. So we retain two thresholds. One of them relates to revenue, 10% of the revenue. One of them relates to 10% of the assets. Now, although we all agreed with that direction, some of us, me included, raised some concern. Oh, maybe are we catching less transaction that we intended originally? We all, at least I know myself, decided to park this for now. I don't have any better solution. Let's continue with this one. And in the future, we'll see the entire package, and I'm sure we can make an informed decision at that time. We also discussed the exemption. So as you remember, we have an exemption from disclosing some required information. We decided to retain the exemption, and we decided to refine it to allow companies to apply the exemption if disclosure would breach specific statutory, legal, or regulatory requirement. We thought it's really necessary in this case. We did not feel the same about other reasons that stakeholders told us to consider, for example, situations involving negative social or operational consequences, or to provide, and we decided not to provide additional application guidance on this topic as well. I think we take it as far as we could at this point, and I think we got a good balance out of that exercise.
Right. And there was a third item that we discussed, which related to our project, but was really not focused on IFRS 3, but really on IAS 36. That is the proposal to remove the requirement to exclude restructuring and enhancement cash flows when calculating the value in use of an asset or a CGU in an impairment test. We decided to proceed with a proposal to remove the requirement. I have to say that this wasn't a unanimous decision. There was some opposition by board members, I think, and their concerns are absolutely acknowledged. But I think on grounds of practicability, I think a majority of our board members came to the conclusion, let's go down that path. We also decided not to add any further application guidance or examples because that may actually increase the complexity and run counter to what we wanted to achieve. So, in this project, then, what are the next steps? We will finish discussing the feedback from the recent consultations and discuss the overall package of proposed amendments to IFRS 3 relating to performance and expected synergy information. So stay tuned if you do have an interest in that. Just to be complete, at the April meeting, the IASB voted and didn't object to six agenda decisions finalized by the IFRS Interpretations Committee in March 2026. Most of these agenda decisions are on IFRS 18, so very timely and very important. And we hope that this provide a recent and good basis for companies to implement IFRS 18. I recommend you listen to an IFRIC podcast available on our website to learn more about it. To our listeners following the Intangible Assets Project, be aware that the project team will be back in the board in May, so just a month from now, where they will be presenting their findings in the stream, exploring user information needs, so stay tuned for that. Well, with that, thank you very much for listening. We look forward to next month's updates. Goodbye from both of us.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Please contact us on communications@ifrs.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions. You can also sign up for email alerts on our website, ifrs.org, or find us on social media.